20, 21, early 20s, 25, 19, 40 years. Congratulations, you made it. So, people on the younger side, they come, and the Islam that they hit when they come is perhaps not everything that they might expect in 2016. Some of us, I know myself, sometimes I speak and people think, wow, he's not only British, he's not only part of a British colonial empire that faded a long time ago, but he's also speaking from the last century. Yeah, this. I was born in 1956. I was 10 years old when I probably came to America. That's a long time ago. Long time ago. Many of us leaders are trying to present Islam to a whole new generation. So what I want to do, I don't want to speak too long because I know you're in a stuffy room and there's a lot of you. Some of the recent research by anthropologists and sociologists, particularly in America, very interesting study, was concluding that people, one of the reasons why people don't like organizations, ours included, but any organization, was that because people naturally, biologically, like to be part of a support group or support groups, which support the basic human functions. So they study groups in the Amazon jungle, and the optimum size of a village entity that people feel most comfortable with is 148. A long way from the Amazon jungle, the Mennonites, the Amish, the Hutterites, they stop their village development at 150. Most people would like to be part of a group of 15 for personal support. And this is the number of people that would, the level of emotional intimacy which is greatest in that group is if you lost your money and you said to the person, "Prabhu, I've lost my money belt, I've lost my passport, can you help me?" How many of you, I will ask you, how many of you have people that would immediately lend you money and try to help you in your dire situation? Put your hand up if you've got people in that group. Okay. You go into hospital. Okay, you go into hospital. This person comes and sees you in hospital. How many of you have three people back in your home country? Not here in India, but back in your home country, if you go to hospital, how many of you would have someone who would come to personally visit you in hospital? That is amazing. May I tell you that you're also loved? Okay. Many people in Western society particularly can't count even one person, okay, that would come and visit them in the hospital. Yes, they send them a Facebook message, "Get well soon." They send them an email, "So sorry to hear that you lost your money in India. Hope you managed to sort it out." We build societies where people don't actually know the names of people who live next door to them. So when people come to ISKCON, they're looking for these things. They're looking for emotional intimacy. They're looking for closeness. They're looking for solutions to problems. Nobody joins ISKCON, the organization, because postmodern people don't like organizations. We join a group of people who will help us in our spiritual search. And that's what seems to be working. So ISKCON seems to work best when it's a confederation of small clusters, each member of whom looks after the other one. Because that is biologically supportive of our existence. It's psychologically and emotionally helpful. And it gets things done. 30, you're pushing it. Many people say to me, "What was it like to be part of ISKCON in the old days?" I said, "What do you mean?" They say, well, Islam in the old days had a family feeling. I say, yes, that's because we all lived in the same house. There was usually, on average, 8 to 10 people living in a suburban house. And that was it. There was a cut-off only because of the size of the house. There were a few places like Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Bombay, Delhi, London, maybe. But there was a cut-off point. The family feeling comes from that sense of emotional connection. Okay, I want to distribute these because we're going into an analysis of some of the trends of thought that come with the postmodern collective ideas. And I'm wondering if you can please distribute these on both sides for me.
There are some more coming.
So what we're going to try to do is to look through some of the elements that may make your preaching unattractive and therefore some of the corresponding elements you may want to introduce into your preaching which may make it slightly more interesting and connected. Sorry if you all don't get one, but perhaps you can share what we're trying to do towards that. Okay. So, are you okay so far?
Yes.
Okay. We just didn't expect it would be this tilt. Okay. If you could, if you have one between two, that's probably good for you. I'm very postmodern too, very emotionally connected to the person sitting next to you. Okay. So some of these elements work for us, and some of these elements work against us. Social psychologists, they're coming, more is coming. Social psychologists have said when you reach 150, you really, really start to need to begin another community. Don't even try going past 150. We had a, you know, when was it, the 1990s? Gosh. Twice in my life I've seen 10 years of preaching, you know, blood, sweat, and tears of preaching wiped out. Usually by spiritual leadership crises or spiritual leadership competition. When we had a sort of Goliath competitor in England, we lost 164 people. But part of the appeal was not that people really disliked Islam, it's just they couldn't really find the emotional connectivity that they really wanted. So the reason why this is important is so that we don't lose people in the future and that we connect with them better when we are making our first contact. So postmodern people, and those of you who have read a bit about this will be able to fill in some of these gaps. All I've done really is done some reading and condensed it down into some headings. So please forgive me if it's not everything we already know. Let's just to keep the ambience and room up. Can I ask someone to read out one statement each on relational rather than hierarchical?
Suspicion of mainstream, the first flat organization.
Yes, thank you. Next one.
Yes. More individual relations than relating to a business.
Yes. Postmodern recategorizes Islam from a movement to an institution. What's the difference? What is the difference, actually?
Postmodern
You look in a dictionary. A movement is just a movement of people. And an institution is a movement of people that's been moving for some time. It's instituted. It has parts of it that work in the same way, consistently, and has been doing so. So then, next one. Let's read this last one. Nice and loud. Yes, any problems with that? Any problems with the guru being in an organizational position? GBC are wondering what to do about it. So that's why they're sending us essays called, you know, Parallel Lines of Authority. It's a big problem, isn't it? Maybe it's a bigger problem than we acknowledge. The reason it's a problem is because the guru is not actually an organizational position. It's a relational role. It's a relational role that has been allowed to become an organizational position. Not technically, but in the minds of the membership, which is a problem. Because if it is an organizational position and I don't like organizations, then I reject the guru. So this is a problem for us. Yes, sir? The guru, twice. Yes. I'm saying, with the what comes with this is a projection onto what should be a relationship role as an organizational position. And we have this test. We say to young devotees, we say, Prabhupada Seven System, GVC, regional supervisor or circle supervisor, regional temple president, please take this label, take the guru, and fit him into the hierarchy of the organization where you think he belongs. And you see them go up to the board and they're trying to scratch him in here and here and here. And I mentioned some of them put him above the GBC. We tried that, that doesn't work. Okay? We've done that, haven't we? Then we put him under the GBC, put him above the temple president. No, that doesn't work. So, we have to be clear, and people thank us for being clear. But it also means that people don't like the guru anyway, because they don't like authority figures. One thing that we have learned is that everybody wants a guru, that's fine, but nobody wants to be told what to do. Okay? This is postmodernism. This is something that we have to deal with in our movement. One Russian, or I won't say, one senior figure in our movement, he said, actually what we've worked ourselves into is a position, due to all this, where a person has a guru, but who doesn't tell them, the group doesn't tell them what to do. This suits everybody. In other words, the guru doesn't tell the disciple what to do, the temple president doesn't tell the disciple what to do, and this suits the temple president, and it suits the guru, and it suits the disciple. Except that it's not spiritual life. Spiritual life means you have a guru, and you don't treat the guru like a friend. The guru is a friend up to the time, of initiation, after initiation. He's a guru, which means there's a change in the relationship. I'm sorry, I'm fading into my other presentation, which comes after this one, I shouldn't. Did you want to say something more?
Yeah, in that light.
In that light, what I've experienced is guru is more of a facilitator, because I have that personal experience in America, rather than the boss or someone in charge.
Yeah. Is that because that's how people want you to be?
That's how people not only want you to be, that's the only way they'll relate to you.
Okay. Anybody else have that experience outside America? The guru as facilitator? Okay. I've heard this a lot from, because I keep in touch with Buddhist monasteries, and I keep in touch with, you know, Zen people, different people in religious circles. I find this everywhere. People want the guru as a friend, or as we say in England, a chum. You know, they kind of want that when they want that, but not at other times, because it's the effect of the age. So this is something to be wary of. How do we solve that problem? I don't know. Is that a question?
What these points are.
Yeah. Are they, these are, I was unclear what you were saying, these are points that we want to avoid, or these are conceptions that postmoderns have?
Yeah. Yes, there's no answers on this paper that I've given you. It's just a thought-provoking session. These are, if you boil down some of the conceptions of the age, this is how it's expressed. Okay. Well, let's move on, shall we? Because here's some good stuff that people really do like about us. Spiritual rather than rational. But it also means we have to preach in a different way. Okay? I'll start off. Feelings along with rationality. Really do like myths, magic, sadhus, badas, people who can do miraculous things. They don't necessarily love always the rational side of our philosophy. They need it in order to be able to believe that they can go forward, but they don't always appreciate it up, over and above the concept that Krishna can work magic in your life. Another point here is this is a question. Is this because of the feminization of society? Back to Noam Maharaj, could you come and just... I'm asking you as a sannyasi to talk about the feminization of society. And what we talked about the other day, the virtual reality for men, and how it's... Yes. Give him a round of applause, please. Back to Noam Swami. We talked about this. I think most people need them towards the back. Maharaj has done some research on this because as a preacher, he also finds that there are tendencies here in India towards this.
That was a surprise, I didn't expect you to call me. It's just a casual talk I had with Prabhu Maharaj and Prabhu, when we were just talking about this presentation of postmodernism. I just shared with him something I knew. Or a research center by a psychologist called Tudson Model, who does a lot of work on that. And he spoke about how it's the women and females who are outperforming men and boys in schools, colleges, also in the corporate houses. And we have a reason for that. And in schools, you can see it in India, we can see all the top rows of schools are all girls. And the boys have taken a little subdued second row on the back side. And it's happening more and more. And the fact is because of excessive indulgence in the digital age. Those people who are born into a digital age, they call us as digital natives anymore. And the others are digital migrants like us, who in between our life become some digital experience. So these who are more familiar with digital stuff and they're more familiar with these access means and usages, smartphones, pads, they get lost, the men get lost into that, get attracted a lot more to that, and they lose their sense of relationships. And so women, they perform much better. They, he said, don't very much get attracted to machines. They keep their relationships among themselves and they always want somebody to talk to. They pick up the phone and thought they use the smartphones for talking to somebody else for longer times. In India case it's very prevalent. And this way the men have got into something called arousal addiction. They get to be very happy about pointing the mouse and clicking and getting a sense of control over everything that they do. and getting instant, generation of some type of an entertainment or feeling of control. Very instantly it happens. And so they indulge a lot in that, pornography, all sorts of other kind of stuff. And over a period of time, they lose a sense of relationship, and that's why women find it difficult to relate with these type of men who have got this arousal addiction. And they divorce them. They find that this guy doesn't have any romantic feeling, he doesn't relate with me, he doesn't talk to me, he doesn't have a relationship with me. And so they break. And there are a lot of divorces happening, he says, because of this. It's because men have failed and do not know how to actually relate. And they feel better and comfortable psychologically with machines who respond to them the way they want to control it. But other beings, especially women, don't respond that way. And therefore, he said this thing is happening. And he spoke about how the workforce is increasing and more people want to employ women because they can relate better with the people under them and they have a better relationship and they can extract much better work and stuff like that. So this is some sort of a trend that's maybe a few years ago that I haven't read about. I don't know how much it's relevant to you. That's a piece of knowledge.
It's relevant.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm so sorry we have to speed through this, but the next part is we know that how masculine dominated religious hierarchies have really repressed spirituality. So much so that Islam may be the only movement, perhaps Buddhism a little, to give genuine spiritual messages. And in many cases, although we are leaders of the ISKCON institution, which for so many of us represents the mechanics, the infrastructure, the buildings, etc., the finances, over 90% of disciples now have never lived in a temple and probably never will, which means that ISKCON's boundaries are much more fuzzy. And that helps us in many different ways. People are looking for a mystical element, they're looking for spirituality rather than religion. Even to the point where in many, many conversations now, I don't even use the word religion, even in the expression Krishna consciousness is the perfection of religion. Religion is the thing that makes people plant bombs. Religion is the thing that makes fully grown men with beards cut children's heads off in a market square. No one is really interested in religion. So it may be worth looking at the way we use language or be prepared to be challenged on your use of language until you redefine it. And there's lots of trigger words that we still use in ISKCON that may just, set a person off. And you know what they are. Either the feminization of society or the search for spirituality has led to a backlash with intellectuals, a backlash of rationalism. So against religion, there are many neo-atheists who have written books against the excesses of religious belief. And this has even succeeded in drawing many of our members away, because sometimes the rational, in our bid to speak to a postmodern audience, we may stress the spiritual rather than the rational, and they take to Krishna consciousness, and then the rational comes in. They look at their life a few years later after initiation and they think, yeah, it doesn't make sense. It really doesn't make sense. In fact, there's a lot of stuff in Krishna consciousness that doesn't make rational sense. And actually, Dawkins he's got some good points. Sam Harris has got some good points. Christopher Hitchens has got some good points. And we have lost, we've lost people over that. And I've had discussions with some devotees who have gone from being ultra-spiritual to ultra-rational. We can't forget the rational element, so there's a balance there.
Have you heard this one before? It's a quote by Deepak Chopra. He says, I'd rather be in a room full of people who are spiritual seekers than sitting next to someone on a plane who'd found his spiritual path. Yeah? Why? The spiritual seekers leave it open. They're ready to listen to you. But part of postmodernism is that you can't tell me anything conclusive. So don't talk about the absolute truth. Huh? Who are you to tell me that you've got the absolute truth? And you may say, well, the absolute truth is not coming from me, sir. It's coming from the Vedas. You run into another problem. Some ancient texts. I put an example here. Krishna consciousness is the topmost yoga. Okay, well, before you start telling me about the topmost yoga, you may want to tell me about what it is that your culture produces. Okay? So, inclusive rather than exclusive. Postmodern people don't like to pigeonhole others. We really have a problem with Parnashram, don't we? Yes. Even with our own devotees, you start talking about Parnashram, and they just think you're talking about cows and cabbages. You talk about the stratification of society to an American. Okay? The stratification of society where there's high class people. I've had people come to me and they say, what does Prabhupada mean when he said high class people, low class person? I mean, it just uses up hours of my time. High class person, low class person, let's not even get started with that. Varna and ashram. Actually, ashram, we talk a lot about, isn't it? In ISKCON, we talk about ashram a lot, too much. Okay? Vanaprastha, is he brahmachari? Is he brahmachari thinking of getting married? Is he married thinking of Vanaprastha? Is he a sannyasi? Is he a good sannyasi? Is he a bad sannyasi? Is he sannyasi preachers? Is he a sannyasi guru or guru GBC? Or is he a sannyasi GBC? We think a lot about ashram. Okay? We get it all mixed up. Okay? Is he a Maharaj or is he a Guru Maharaj? Which is it? But we don't like talking about Varna. No one ever talks about Varna. It's a little bit uncomfortable for us, isn't it? We're really more attracted to the free, floating ISKCON system where you can be a manager but not really have any talent for managing. That really suits us. You know, because you're a good devotee, you can be put in a management position, but not be any type of manager whatsoever. And you buy a farm up the mountainside, and it doesn't grow any crops because it's the wrong place. Because you're not a Vaishnava. So the type of people that we're talking about like social inclusivity. I like everybody to be part of it. The difficulty when I bring people here to India, because as soon as they see one poor person, that's it. This is what your Krishna consciousness has produced. They want to blame India's modern problems. So they want to blame Krishna consciousness for all of India's modern problems. Finally, this is a big one. Culture friendly. A person prefers to be culture friendly than be accused of being anachronistic. Okay? And this is where we get into things like Krishna West. Okay? What is the most important? Is our cultural legacy important? Is our cultural legacy important? Because it is important. But I have seen Jewish men in Jerusalem wearing the clothing, the woolen clothing and the woolen hat, and the woolen gaiters and the woolen socks of an 18th century Polish businessman praying at the Wailing Wall with the sweat streaming down their faces. Their cultural legacy is perfectly intact. Their climatic adjustment of clothing is all over the place. it doesn't work. And yet it works. It works, but it does not work. Tadure tadvantiki. Taratanasya sarvasya tarusarvasya sifaya. I've also seen devotees distributing books in a dhoti in Sweden in freezing conditions. These clothing, this clothing, firstly, cotton grows in India. It's from here. When the Christian tradition was brought out of the Holy Land in Egypt, they went from cotton to wool. That's why all these 14th, 15th century monks, they walk around in wool hats, because it's cold. Because it's cold. So there's a bit of a debate going on now about what clothing you should wear in order to preach. It's not a new thing, actually. One of the great champions of, the champion of Krishna West is Holiness Hridayana Maharaj. I had a 2-hour conversation with him, and I said, Maharaj, I can remember in 1976 standing in front of Srila Prabhupada dressed in a jacket, trousers, and an ordinary shirt with a flat cap. And oh, by the way, a wig. And Prabhupada looked out, because we were distributing books at the airport. Prabhupada looked at us, as two men, and he said, he turned to Brahmananda Swami and he said, "Who are these men?" And Brahmananda Swami said, "They're our men, Srila Prabhupada." Brahmananda told me that. So, Karani Kashyapu said, you know, beware of Vaishnavas who come in disguise. Because he was thinking Vaishnavas have a tendency to dress in different clothing, and then some of them may have come to the school and taught my Prahlad. So it seems that it's not a new thing. To dress. I was invited to the Queen's, the Buckingham Palace, the picnic, the garden party with the Queen. And on the invitation card from the Lord Chancellor, it said, "Please wear national dress or a morning suit." I don't have a suit. My national dress, if I wore English national dress, I'd be dressed like a Morris dancer with a straw hat. A little bit like Mahavishnu Maharaj. with a straw hat and little funny shoes and bells.
Pink and green shoes.
And so I went dressed like this, and it was very interesting to be with lords and ladies, all of them were wearing top hats and tails. And they would go like this, they would look at me, and their faces would fall, they'd go. But then they realized, when they got to my toes, they realized, and yet, the Queen has invited this person to be here. He must be somebody that I don't know. And by the time they got up to me, they go, "Hello." That's a British boy. "How are you?" So the debate goes on. In some circumstances, when it's cold, a dhoti is definitely not the thing to wear. Okay? Oh dear. Have I said the wrong thing? Saris seem to be good anywhere. You can wear them on a red carpet, too. You can wear them to a big civil function. Dhotis just don't seem to cut it in the same way. If you are going to wear a dhoti, please don't wear dark underwear. If you are going to wear a dhoti, make sure it actually does cover your legs. And the dhoti should reach down to your ankles as well. Okay? There are a few wardrobe malfunctions in the dhoti department that we see all over the world. So just choose clothing. However, postmoderns, does it actually help to dress in different clothing? I'd like now to invite a well-known protagonist to leave aside any contemporary northeast-west or any other direction. So let us hear from His Holiness Guru Krishna Maharaj, who always actually is impeccably dressed.
Well, actually, you're asking a very interesting question, because I've been involved in managing Krishna West. Hridayananda Maharaj is up there, but he's never had anything to do practically with Krishna West. So I'm on the ground with it. So when we first started Krishna West, I was thinking that if I wore Dhoti, it would freak out the students. This is actually an interesting experience. So I came in Western dress. And guess what happened? They just looked at me like their buddy. Because there is some need to look up to people. They don't like hierarchy. That's what I'm saying. But they feel some shelter, or they need some difference with people. So I was not so effective in Western dress. This was contrary to Vinayananda Maharaj's experience. In fact, he was so upset with our Krishna West program because the first devotee we made wanted to be my disciple rather than his. And then he moved to the West Coast after that point. So then I started to experiment wearing a dhoti with Krishna West. And the people related to me in a more respectful fashion, although I wasn't taking the position of being like their big boss or big guru or anything like that, and calling me Gurudev and listening to spiritual instruction and taking shelter. And of course, it had to be done very carefully to avoid certain words like preaching or God or religion, like you were talking about. But everyone else wears Western dress, but not me. Because the people, we want people to take shelter. People have that need, I've seen. You know, the social networking, elective religion, like you were talking about, but people have that need to take shelter of a particular individual. Not institution. As soon as you're in the institution, then that's it, they're out the door. But if you have someone who's friendly, who's fatherly, I mean, that's the guru issue, the guru position. Like a father, someone who cares for someone, someone who can facilitate you, not your boss. And then they're very available. That's been my experience. And Vinayananda Maharaj doesn't like it that much that I relayed that to him. Because he's really into Western dress.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
I didn't join ISKCON, a worldwide organization. I joined 20 people who were living in George Harrison's house in the countryside. After 3 days, those 20 people said to me, "You know, what we do and what pleases the guru is if you go out on book distribution." ISKCON then, for me, shrunk from 20 people down to 4 people. And that was the ISKCON I lived in for 6 years. Small is beautiful. I don't know whether I could have joined ISKCON now. So I have to, look at ISKCON now and think, how can we give it a friendlier, more accessible entry point? How can we make it relational rather than hierarchical when people contact us? How we can use some of these points anyway as an idea to create a rock solid institution, but one that has fuzzy edges. Fuzzy edges where I can be valued as an individual, where I don't have to relate to a whole bunch of people, but just a small group of people that will treat me as the individual I wish to be. We have to be a little careful of our language. You know, people don't shoot rhinos anymore. Do you know that? We don't shoot rhinos. And yet, how many Sunday feasts I've heard, "Well, when you go preaching, you have to shoot for the rhino." And I watch people and they go, "Why would you do that? Why would you shoot a rhino?" First of all, I'm a vegetarian. First of all you are vegetarians, and anyone who shoots a rhino just sucks. Why would you shoot? It's an old British expression. So India learned this expression through the British, but got rid of the British, and there are some things that just don't, they jar.
It's a white rhino.
Huh?
It's a white rhino. It's white.
Shooting the white rhino. Shooting the white rhino. So that's okay, is it? You can't shoot a white rhino anymore because they're extinct, right? White elephant. We don't shoot them either. So looking at your language, looking at your choices of expressions, looking at what you looking at how you explain Krishna consciousness so that you get the terminology which is of maximum effect. Yes.
You're talking about language. There's so much negative language about business. So.
Oh, don't get me started. I have two daughters, now fully grown. One's 28 and one's 25. And they have grown up in ISKCON. Actually, they've grown up in my family. So with a lot of love and attention and a lot of explaining why certain things, we never told them that you can't lead kirtan. We never told them that women can't do this and women can't do that. And as a result, I think my two daughters are functioning members of ISKCON who want to be associated with ISKCON and want to carry on doing what they do, which is leading kirtan, and you know, they lead kirtan all over the place because no one in their life ever told them that they can't. Yes, there's this little place called the temple where maybe the boys are a bit pushy. And maybe it's all the boys who play around there, but really 50% of the population, just if you haven't noticed, but one scientist told me that 50% of the population is female. I don't know whether you've heard that statistic at all. It means that 50%, it's more, 50% of our preachers are female. 50% of the people that we talk to and introduce Krishna consciousness to are female. Now I know we have a hardcore of saffron, and believe me, I've been there. You don't speak to women, like I said, you just ask, can you pass the salt? That's the maximum conversation. But our society is now 90% people who live in different situations. But sometimes that is not reflected. Actually, we did a survey, and we discovered that of the temple population, 70% is male, 30% is female. That's people living in the temple. Of devotees who do not live in the temple, that's fully functioning devotees of Krishna, 60% are female, 40% are male. Go figure. But those are the figures. And what it means is that just our strategy for teaching and introducing, we could be more female friendly than we are. And that's just, I'm not what you might call a feminist. Yeah, I do have a wife and I have two girls and a boy. And I have learned by my experience that you don't have to be a feminist in order to want to create a movement which is welcoming for really 60% of the population. Because a lot of the ideas of spiritual, mystical, the divine feminine, I mean, we have a lot going on. Divine feminine, there's no other religion that has a concept of the divine feminine. Radha, Lakshmi, Sita. This is very appealing to women. So we have to make sure that when women are given a chance to understand what we've got, that they're able to take it to the next step, next step, next step, next step. Okay, my next presentation is about the different steps involved in bringing a person to Krishna consciousness. But I thank you very much. I think we've reached the end of our... No, we have 5 more minutes.
Yeah.
A couple of Mr.
Spasibo. Just louder.